this interview is conducted by Wendell Ham, a history major at Somerset Community College for the Kentucky Bicentennial Oral History Project. The interview was conducted at Mr. Hasty's house on March 16th at 11 o'clock. Mr. Hasty, first of all, I'd like to thank you for doing this, participating, and just like to ask you a few questions. If there's any of them that you don't want to answer or so forth, just let me know and throw it out. First of all, one thing that we've talked about before, and I know you can go into as deep a detail if you want to, but tell me about the time when you raised hemp for the government for rope back during the war.
Well, I don't recall just what year it was. Probably in the 40s. We had the landlord, Mr. P.L. Bagg, had a contract with the government to raise 5 acres of seed hemp. Well, I raised, around 3 acres of it, and the other tenant on the farm had 2 acres. And it was quite an experience. I had never in all my life witnessed any seed hemp being grown. I worked in hemp when they broke it for fiber. And my understanding is that during the time prior to just prior to this occasion was that they found they could import the fiber from South America cheaper than they could buy the hemp. And so they had done that, and so therefore the fiber hemp industry just died out in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And the reason they brought it back is my understanding that they were fearful during the war that submarines would disrupt the sea lanes, and therefore they were preparing for this emergency. And Commodity Credit Corporation, known as the CCC, issued these contracts, and the people raised the hemp, broke it, cleaned the seed, and returned it to a station close to them, and then they, in turn, returned it to the ICC, to the CCC, and what they done with it, I don't know, but it was preparing to go back into the fiber business is why they did this. And I raised 3 acres on Hanging Fork Creek on a P.O. back farm, and it was quite an experience.
What was it like raising in comparison to back or so forth?
Well, it was similar in some ways. What you did, you laid your rows off 4 feet apart. And you laid them off two ways, so you could plow two ways in it, you see. And you planted your seed where these rows crossed, and that was the fourth. And you grew the hemp, which grew to be, and in my case at least, I had a river bottom in about close to 3 acres. And it grew to be 15, 16 feet tall. And you had to go through it, keep it completely clean. And before it matured, you had to, if a morning glory climbed the stalk, you had to unwind that and break it off, because the morning glory, they claimed, would have enough strength in the vine to mature seeds on up, and they were so near the size and weight of hemp seed, they were impossible to clean out. And before you, there's a male and female plant in hemp. And one of them blooms, and the other, I think, seeds. And when that plant bloomed, you had to go through and cut it out and just drop it on the ground. The one that blooms, I think, the male plant, and the female then bore seed. You cut it in 12 by 12 hills, shocks, we call them. Put them in shocks, set them up. Prop them up against each other. And that naturally created a 24 by 24 space between 4 shocks of hemp. And when you broke it, what we call breaking the seed out, you would place a 24 by 24 tarpaulin or sheet, cotton sheet, and tear up the stalks, clean off the ground, and place this thing down between four shocks. That's two rows of shocks. And then you would turn these shocks over on the sheet and take a crooked stick and a pole and beat the thing till the seat died. And then you would pick them up and run to a sieve and partially clean them in the field and sack them up and take them to the barnyard where you ran them through a wheat van. And that was it.
Took
it to the holding station for the CCC.
Do you remember what you made?
Well, I had a disastrous thing happen to me. After my hemp matured and I shocked it and it dried, I had a very hot, dry spell of weather with a hard wind, and it blew over. I had 109 shocks on that field, and it blew all of them over, partially over, but 11. And therefore, I lost a lot of seed on the ground. And actually, what I got out of it, I had 109 bushels was all I saved. And I believe I sold it for, I forget what I got for it, but it's 48 pounds a bushel. And I got I forget what it was, but the whole thing, by the time I got it cleaned and re-cleaned, and then the holding station where I took it, they claimed to clean out 12 or 13 bushels of weight. I think I got chipped there, but anyway, I don't know that. And I wound up with about $100 and some odd. That's about all I got out of the 3 acres. However, I believe I would have made money if I hadn't had this hot, dry wind that blew over my shocks, and there was just rest of seed laying along the ground that you couldn't pick up because
it's just ruined.
Yeah.
Of course, the value, it's changed quite a bit today.
Yeah. If you had to do that today, it would probably cost you 5 or 6 or 7 times as much as it did me, because fortunately I was able to do most of the work myself, because it came at a time when you could put it off between other work and that. And just about fall back on that when you wasn't doing something else. In other words, when you got in the shock, as long as it stayed dry and it didn't blow over, any time you got that shock dry and turned over on that sheet and beat it out, you had your seed there. So, of course, you could have left them through the winter and they would have rotted, but as long as you got it in the fall, well, you're doing all right.
Another question I wanted to ask you. You told me once before about remembering, I think it was it your mother and father or your grandparents were making pipe tobacco?
Oh, that was later on. That was that's not been too many years ago. I had an uncle that lived in Pulaski County, just in the edge, east and edge of Pulaski County, little town of Mentonville. He and his wife both smoked a pipe, and they would take the upper grades of tobacco, which is the brighter red, the heavier grades, and they would let it dry, and they would crumble it up to where it was smoking tobacco, and they would take water and brown sugar and make a light syrup, really wasn't a syrup, it was just sweetened water. And it would moisten this tobacco, really wet it. And then it would put it in a pan and spread it very thin, and it put it in the oven or the cooking stove and dry it out. And you smoked it in the pipe. I have done that in my lifetime. But you needed the upper grades of tobacco, which you usually used, and this leaf tobacco that had been cured and not sold on the market. And you would put sugar and water and sugar, most brown sugar. It made a passable substitute for processed smoking tobacco.
Not too many people nowadays that say I do that, I know.
It's really a poor man blend of smoking tobacco.
A lot of farmers twist their own that they raise, but I never heard of anyone making their own pipe tobacco.
It used to be a habit in the stripping room when you had a slack time that people would, even the people who grew it, or people who were working as for stripping by the day, that there wasn't no hourly work then stripping the back, you stripped by the day, or stripped your own, and they would take some of the lower grades, bright and red, not the damaged grades, and they would stem it on the at dinner time when you're sitting waiting after you eat dinner, while they would twist that, and it was perfectly all right if you were just working for a man to take a few leaves and make you a few twists and take them home with you, you know. Because in those days they sold all the tobacco. There wasn't no problem then where you were allowed to sell so many pounds. And tobacco was, well, I sold the crop 13 cents a pound. And I remember my daddy, and when he was raising tobacco during, right after World War I, tobacco the previous year during the war had brought farmers around $1 a pound. And they naturally assumed it was set up that way, you know, that's the way people do. And next year they just jumped in, farmers, and put in all the tobacco they could possibly handle, hired labor at higher prices then than you ever heard of, $5 a day and board, and raised a crop that they, when they took it off many times, they'd have to bring part of it back. It wouldn't bring enough to pay for selling it on the floor. 2 cents a pound, which won't pay for floor expenses. They would bring it back home.
Of course, now things have changed. They bail it and all it.
There was a joke going around those days that they'd take your load of tobacco off, you took your chicken, where you'd pay the floor expenses.
I think this here, this next question, I think it was pretty recently. I'm not sure. I know you've talked about it before. When you went to, I think it was Pulaski County one time, and funeral possession, and they still had the...
Yeah, that was when this uncle that used to make the smoking tobacco, when he died. As I say, they lived in a right about a half a mile or a mile from a little town called Mentonville, and it's right on, you might say, right on the Casey and Pulaski County land. And it's just a small village. Had a sawmill, make a couple stores, half a dozen houses, and it's right out in the middle of woodland. You just come up on it all at once and you leave it the same way. And when he died, we went to his funeral. He married my mother's sister. His name was John Dye. And he was at his home. Body was at the home, just like, you know, wasn't at a funeral home. And when they went to take him to the graveyard, they took him in a two-horse jolt wagon, just a wooden wheel, old regular old farm wagon. And most of the people down there, they rode horseback or drove a buggy or like that. I was down there one time on Sunday morning. I was leaving there. We'd stayed there the night before, and it was about time to go to church, and it was just, the roads were just quite full of people going to various churches, and they were riding buggies, wagons, and horses and mules. Wasn't unusual to see a boy and his girlfriend on the same animal. Him riding astride in front of her, she sitting sideways at the back with her arms around him, you know. Yeah, that was in Pulaski County, Casey. Was that all? I've lost my
track there. Yeah, you covered it pretty good. This next question, I really don't know. It's probably a pretty broad question. You've seen the major wars that this country's been in the last century.
Wars.
Yeah. World War I, II. Korean and Vietnam.
Yeah.
You've seen the impact left on the country after each war. You've had a son fight in Vietnam. See, actually in Vietnam. And
a brother that was in World War II.
Could you just kind of briefly discuss some of the things that you remember of some of the
wars of... Yeah, go ahead.
Like Pearl Harbor, I know you remember that.
I remember that very distinctly.
Could you give us just a little bit on what you remember of that?
Well, actually, in World War One, I was just, I was born in 1912, and I suppose it occurred sometime around the 19th century, which would have been 1918, 1919, and it ended somewhere close to that, so I would have been around five, six, 7 years old, and I was just a child. In those days, it was very seldom you saw a car, automobile. And back then, it's a farm we lived on, they owned one, and there was a fella owned the farm over about 2 miles from that one that owned one, and that was just about all that I know of. You would see an airplane maybe once in 6 months. I don't know too much about that I can say about World War One, because it happened, as I say, when I was a child. I mentioned a while ago the tobacco that was raised the year after the war ended, and prices, of course, tumbled, and a depression set in, possibly, and I remember my father hiring men and boarding them for $5 a day, which was unheard of at that time. And when he sold his tobacco that year, he came out $900 behind, it was just a washout. Then in World War II was when I raised the hemp. That was during that war, and that was the time that my brother James enlisted and served his time out in Virginia and Washington, D.C. in the military police. Following that war, there was not a great depression, but of course there was a change in the environment of the markets and all, but not near as much as there was in World War One. And then during the Korean conflict, I was on a farm that's when John was born, my son, and I was on a farm working by the day. I didn't have any crop or anything, and I was working for $1 a day. And hogs at that time would bring around 28 to 38 cents. That was a whopping price for them. And you could hire labor for $3 a day. It would be a high price for housing tobacco and setting, and that's mostly you get hire a man to set tobacco for you by hand for 10 hours for $1.50. That would be 15 cents an hour. I cut corn during that time for 8 1/3 cents a shock. That was 3 shocks for a quarter. And a shock of corn is either 16 hill square or 16 step square. Well, it would be 16 rows wide and 16 steps long or hills long. And then there was another type of corn cutting or harvesting that was called 18 hill square. It would be 18 rows wide, shock in the middle of 9 rows, in the middle of 18 steps. And of course, I've shucked corn like that for 12 and a half cents. It would make 6 barrels.
At that time, that was pretty good money at that time, wasn't it?
Well, you could live on it.
Yeah.
But there, for the 2 years that I lived on the farm where Johnny was born, I worked for $1 a day. And that was possibly $5.50 a week. For that, I could buy my groceries and keep a little gasoline if I had a car, which I hardly ever did. And that's just briefly as near as I can tell you. Of course, then come on up to the present day. People of today young people especially, are people that did not live through those times, can't believe the stories that we older people tell about the wages, about the living conditions. What we heard that went on, that of course we cannot witness to it because we were not eyewitnesses, we only read it in the papers or heard of it. For instance, I read in the newspapers during the Depression down south when cotton was king down there. Cotton went, I suppose following one of the wars, maybe World War One or Two, when cotton prices went just like tobacco prices did here. And people down there in the South had done what the burley growers in Kentucky had done in the burley belt. They'd concentrated on the money crop, which was cotton down there and the burley up here. Well, when this disaster price depression hit, they would just hit just like the burley growers were here. One time down there, I remember reading that a man read 40 acres of cotton. And he would, for that, he would be furnished a mule, a plow, and a shanty. And he and his family, and he was also furnished at on credit, a staple diet, such as what they offered, just in the country store, then was just meat. Well, they said there was, and at the time, Huey Long was in power down there as senator, or whatever he was senator, I think. They called him the Kingfish. He was eventually machine gunned down on the courthouse steps, I believe, in Louisiana. And he was a fighter for, as we call him today, for human rights, I suppose. And he discovered, and when he came into power, into office down there, and began to investigate, of course, he might have known it all along, that as high as 300 families were living outside. They had no place to go, in thickets along the roadsides. They were just out like people going out on a day's outing. That's where they lived. And he said that he discovered children down there, young people, 15 or 16 years old, that was infected with a disease called rickets or pellagra. And he said that it resulted from a diet that was staple down there at the end of the three M's, he called it, meat, meal, and molasses. It's about all they offered in those plantation commissaries, which were passed for a grocery store. And one of the places they could buy groceries because they were buying them against the price of cotton this fall. It was what they call dry salt meat, just fat back, and meal. And a Louisiana product called Blackstrap molasses. It was the New Orleans molasses. They called them the one brand of New Orleans, and they were made basically for livestock. They were bitter, but they were palatable enough that you could eat them. And he said that these children, the reason that they were in this condition, had been fed a diet of the three M's, he called it, meat, meal, and molasses. And therefore they didn't have any, when they got this 40 acres is what they got. And they were furnished a mule and a plow, they said, to raise this with. And of course the farm father plowed and the children chopped and picked and whatever. And there was no garden, no vegetables, because they were engrossed totally in raising a cash crop. And since then, of course, they've reformed that country down there to more modern needs and raised vegetables and stuff. But in those days, a man was just almost indentured himself as a slave to the plantation owner. Well, neither one of them didn't fare too good.
He was
the man owned the land. He had to sell the cotton, and if he couldn't. If the tenant, farmer, couldn't meet his bills, when actually the landowner was stuck with his cotton crop. There were some people that was able, that had enough money enough assets or was able to borrow enough money to buy this cotton and store it till the prices went up to one of our conflicts, maybe. Then he was able to draw down and make himself a fortune.
One more question here I'll ask you. I know you read quite a bit. I'm not for sure how much you read by Kentucky writers. I know you read some.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a little bit of which one you think, a little synopsis on which one's the best Kentucky writer.
You mean, I have that privilege of two books. I think you might have had something to do with them. I don't know. I know I see them as gifts on birthdays or Christmas. I can't tell which. One is by the noted author Jesse Stewart of W. Holland, who died recently. And I suppose that he would rank among the top authors in the state of Kentucky.